I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and thank you for joining us on Desert Isolation Discs. I'm Alex Lawson, and your company is very much appreciated. I really hope you enjoy today's guest, as he's a bit of a legend, he's got a killer taste in music, and a cracking chuckle. Gordon Mack is a soul man. The radio impresario has been DJing since the age of 12 and has music running through his veins. A fixture on the South London club scene, he took a knockback from the radio station JFM as an incentive to set up his own pirate station, KISS. Along with the likes of Norman Jay and Giles Peterson, Gordon has helped champion the music others refused to play. He took the station onto FM and into a huge brand, eventually selling to media conglomerate EMAP. Now he's back running digital station My Soul and home to capture the dancing shoes and minds with new music and classics. We meet up to discuss a few of them in a West London caf. Gordon, I'm fascinated to hear what music you've got for us today. Tell us how a man like you approaches picking your favourite discs.
My goodness, it's the hardest thing in the world. I suppose really what I've done is I've gone through today, and at different points in my life there's been certain records that have just stood out, and they're just records that I can still play today and not feel tired of. And every one of those records I can still play today and I don't feel tired of them at all. Now I have thousands of these records, so to pick just 7, 8 of them or whatever is very, very difficult, but I'm going to give it a go.
Give us a picture of your record collection. Do you have some huge attic at home, or what do you keep them on?
Well, I have a lock-up, which is full of them. They've got about 800 boxes of records in a lock-up. And then I have our dining room. Is one wall of it is all vinyl. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to go through all the boxes that are in lockup and go through and just pick the ones that I really like. So I'm constantly going through records at the moment and just going, right, I like that record. It's not just there for the collection. It's not just there because I've got all the other albums, you know, because I got to the point where you can't house them all in your home. It gets messy. So you've just got to go, this is the wall of the best records that I love. Not so much my work records, because everything now seems to be on MP3 or, you know, CD or disc or whatever. But it's the records that I actually like and can be bothered to put on and then take off the record deck and put another one on.
So let's put on your first one. What is it?
Okay, my first one is 007. It's an old reggae track. I grew up loving reggae because of my a cousin of mine that took me to Chelsea back in 1969 when I was about 9 years old. And she used to go out with a skinhead there. And this is when skinheads liked reggae music, and there was no racial connotations or anything like that. They liked ska, bluebeat, reggae, soul, Motown, Stax, Atlantic. And so her influences, because she was about 5 years older than me, and she took me to my first ever disco when I was about 8 and sort of converted me, and then she kind of introduced me to this reggae music, which from that time on it's always played a baby part in my heart.
Yeah.
So go on, been dancing there. So you mentioned, and we'll come on to Kiss and My Soul and your incredible impact on soulful radio, but just to take it back, you mentioned the disco that you went to there.
Yes.
When I had the pleasure of interviewing you for The Standard, we were chatting about your first DJ set, age 12.
Yes.
Can you treat the listeners to your anecdote about your experience?
I suppose, really, I got into being a disc jockey when I was very early. I used to do a Saturday job in a toy shop down the Woolworth Road, and I used to earn my money there, and then I used to go up to A1 Stores, which was the record shop in the Woolworth Road, and buy my 7 inches and stuff like that. And I used to listen to Emperor Roscoe, Kenny Everett, and all that stuff. So I grew up in a house, and my next track kind of is a track that I grew up with, which came via the influences of my mother and the family. And so I grew up in a house of music, and then when I was about seven or eight, I went to Butlins in Bognor Regis, and my cousin, same cousin that got me into the reggae, she sneaked me out. I was there with my nan and my aunt. She sneaked me out through the window, and she took me to the disco. And it was the first ever disco that I'd ever been to. And it was very basic, I think. All I can remember was it was dark, there was loads of loud noise and music, people dancing and going crazy, and there was lights flashing. And then it's dark and then it's flashing. And I was like, oh my God, I just loved it. And so I just wanted to be a DJ. So I the local church, one day I got my opportunity in 1972 in Halloween, and the DJ never turned up for a church benefit. And so I said, I'll do it. I've got records. I'm only 12 years old at this point. I said, I'll do it. And so,
cocky.
Yeah, I was pushy. And I was on Blue Peter. I was one of those kids. I got a badge. A sew on one and a pin on one. And heard Valerie Singleton swear. Oh my God, that was a shocking thing in my life. Yeah, she said the F word. I was like, oh no, surely not. So this fundraiser at the church, the DJ never turned up, so they got together these two old record decks and put it through the tannoy system, and I went home and got my records. And I actually got to do my first ever DJing gig, which I can always remember. I'd play a record and I'd think, right, DJs are supposed to talk in between each track, so I'm going to talk after the next track. And the next track would finish, and I'd just play another one. I think, well, I'll talk after the next one. And it went on and on and on. Then, you know, it was an elderly ladies there and everything else. And the first time I did talk, I think I introduced the wrong track. And it was just one of those things. But I went home from there and I loved it. That's what I wanted to do. That was it. And I'd done a deal with the vicar, and said to him, let me do all of your fundraisers, and so I'd done a deal, and so I got £2 per gig for the rest of the year. He gave me a contract to do all of them, and on the strength of that, I went and bought my dad, good old Cormac, he stood guarantor for a £200 mobile disco unit. And I actually I paid it back over 3 years, and I said, "That's how I got started." It's just like, anyway.
What's your next song?
Okay,
in that set?
My next song is one that is really dear to my heart, and it's by an artist which I kind of grew up on. My mum played Dionne Warwick in the house. I knew every word to every single Dionne Warwick song. And What the World Needs Love is one of my favourites, but the one I've chosen today is one that I still listen to now, and it still makes me smile. Do You Know the Way to San Jose? I love this track so much.
Stone Cold Classic.
You can really breathe place where I can stay. I was born and raised in San Jose. I'm going back to find some peace of mind in San Jose.
That was the inimitable Dionne Warwick. So, Gordon, tell me, you set up a pirate radio station.
Yes.
In the form of KISS. I mean, to many people, that's almost inconceivable now. How did you go about it?
I went about... Well, the reason I'd done it was because I knew I'd never get on legal radio.
Yeah, so I DJed
on JFM, yeah, and they didn't... They went for a community licence. The guy that ran that, he said, Gordon, he said, I know you've done drive time for us for the last couple of years, but if you get another chance of going to another radio station, then take it, because your speech, you know, you'd have to go to speech therapy to get on a legal radio station.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of thanks and goodbye. And I was mortified. I was like, I mean, I understood, yeah, I'm not the greatest speaker in the world. Still not. But, my God. I was mortified. So I thought, right, okay. Well, if you don't want me, I'll go and set my own one up. And myself and three friends, George Power and Tosca and an engineer, we set up this pirate station because loads of them had gone off at this point. Solar, Horizon, JFM, LWR, they all went off to try and get one of these community licenses, which never ever happened back in 83.
Yeah.
And so that's when I set up KISS.
And what kind of access do people actually have to soul music at that time? I mean, how important was pirate radio?
The landscape back then was so different to today. I mean, that you only had Radio London that had a show, which was one of the shows, which was Robbie Vincent, who was kind of, it was Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
Greg Edwards, who's now on My Soul, but Greg Edwards used to do Capsule Radio on a Saturday evening. Mm-hmm. And then there was David Rodigan, who done the reggae show.
Yeah.
On Saturday evening. And that was, there was one or two other little shows, but that was the main fulfillment that you got from radio of real soul music. And
yeah.
And so you the only other place you heard it was in the record shop, or if you could find a club or a bar or somewhere that actually played the music, and that was very few and far between. I mean, you know, going back to the early 80s, it wasn't like it is today where it's mainstream. It's kind of, it was very, very, we was fighting to let everybody hear about our music, you know. I wanted everyone to hear my latest Fatback band or my latest James Brown track or whatever. I mean, it was kind of Travaris and all these, but I just wanted everyone to hear about them, and you just didn't get it on normal radio.
So the next song you've got for us...
The next song that I've got for you, the one I've actually got queued up here, isn't from back then. It's kind of... It's more now, really, because I thought I'd shuffle it around a little
bit. You are a DJ, absolutely. You know how to create an eclectic mix.
Well, this is an eclectic mix. There's a wonderful jazz singer called Gregory Porter, which I know you know, and he recorded a track called 1960 Watts, which is just wonderful in its true form. But then there's a house remixer called the Opalopo, and I have to try and get that right. And he's done a mix of it, which has put a kind of a really lovely, soulful, but a warm, housey beat underneath it.
Mm.
And it just, Gregory Porter's vocals, which is just amazing. And this is a real kind of My Soul song, and it kind of, it's just...
Yeah.
And it also comes from My Soul. This just sums up wonderful music to me.
1960 what 1960 who 1960 what 1960 who 19 hey the motor city is burning y'all of people standing on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. Shots rang out. Yes, it was a gun. He was the only one to fall down, y'all.
Right, I'm back with Gordon
Matt.
We've been dancing in the window of West London.
I feel quite tight, yeah. I feel like I should be in Amsterdam.
So, Gordon, tell me, you know, in the early days of Kiss, and even later on, you worked with the likes of Norman Jay and Tim Westwood and so many others who also, as well as yourself, went on to become big names. Can you tell me about the atmosphere and what you guys used to get up to?
I don't know if I can say what we got up to, but it was fun. We used to, I mean, to put it into perspective, when Kiss was a pirate, and there was people like Norman Jay and Trevor Nelson and Tim Westwood, and I mean, just all these different, so many different great names. Jonathan Moore, Matt Black, who became Cold Cut, and you know, it was a hub of real talent. Jazzy B was part of it all, and I don't really think that we realised, when we look back now, we go, wow, but at the time, it was kind of, we didn't really recognise it. It was kind of, we were all doing our thing. We were all striving to push our kind of our arts and our kind of to do as many clubs and do, you know. And I don't think really we kind of recognised what we was doing really at the time. You know, that how important, and also it was the time around that, because Kiss was a pirate from 85 to for 3.5 years. That's all it was as a pirate, was 3.5 years, and then we had a year and a half, a year when we came off air, so we had to be off air for a year to go for the license, and then we got the license in 1989 at the end of it, December, and then we had to go until 9 months until September into 1990 to actually, then we came on as a legal station. So it was about 5 years, 5.5 years sort of, that we, from inception of starting it all up and when I founded it, till it be coming on legal. And in that time, it wasn't just the it wasn't just us all doing that. There'd been a history of pirate, but there'd also been a change in the music, because house music came along. And in the short time that we was on air, when Norman Jay done the original Rare Groove show, which was this brand new style of music which kind of came out, and I say brand new music, it was all old music that were Rare Grooves. But they're all old, but it was a new style and a new kind of format. And so you had that. And then within a year or so, or year and a half, 2 years, you had house music come along. And started off with soulful beats like Ten City and stuff like that. And then it got into mad rave music, and it kind of, and that just took the nation by storm. And it wasn't just an underground thing. And what it done was it catapulted all the musics that surrounded it as well into the spotlight. And then you had big raves, and then you had the freedom to party movement. And we kind of, we surfed along the surf, you know, the wave of this, because we were just there. We'd been there, so he was established as a pirate. And when all this happened, we, you know, for instance, Danny Rampling, who was one of our DJs, started off on Kiss playing independent soul, American soul 7 inches, and ended up being the biggest, you know, shum and the biggest happy, happy house DJ that there was, and one of the biggest brands in the whole house scene with the shum brand. And it was just a time of change, and some people, some of the DJs just didn't embrace it and fell by the wayside. And some just took it and went and just never looked back. And so, you know, Judge Jules, I mean, these were all DJs that were all part of us. And, you know, Judge Jules was doing Rare Groove and, you know, Shake and Finger Pop and doing stuff with Norman Jay, the Good Times Roadshow. And within a couple of years, he was doing house music and kind of became later when BBC started, about 5 years down the line later. It was massive. He was this big house DJ, you know, I mean, and an international DJ, and they all became international. And so it was a totally different thing. I mean, you know, also E came along, which changed the perceptions of all the people that were dancing, because they'd all danced and they'd all danced in aircraft hangars, and so it was a whole time of change, and we just was there as a kind of a the vocal point of part a lot of this.
What did, cause when people talk about rave culture, they do talk about aircraft hangars and the fields and the hacienda. What was it like in London at that time? And you know, a typical night view. Are you in some warehouse somewhere?
Well, what used to happen was every Saturday night we used to run. I think it's called Third Base, which was in Camden. So everyone used to go to Second Base, which finished at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. And then everybody would know somebody to phone to, and there would be just cars all going off to a phone box or a motorway station to get instructions on where to go for the rave. And it was just mad, you know, and it was unbelievable, yeah. And, you know, we got involved with some of the raves and stuff like that, but overall, it was... We kept ourselves as a radio station, and just sort of, because we still had shows that we weren't all just rave or what house or whatever, we still had soul shows, reggae shows, and you know, all these other kind of shows.
Yeah.
But it was a total turnaround.
Mm.
And I mean, Norman Jay started off doing Rare Groove, and he started a club called High on Hope, which was down at Dingle's every Thursday, playing soulful house music and that. Total change around. I looked at one of my diaries the other day, and it seemed that every single week there was something new happening. It was quite a crazy time.
So tell us about your next song.
Okay, my next song. This is where I kind of. It's called Flower Duet, and it's a bit of classical music. And I think British Airways went and spoiled it by using it in an advert. Uh-huh. But I have a very Catholic taste when it comes to music. I like all kinds, and this is just a piece of music and a bit of opera that is just, I think it's just beautiful. And I can listen to it from start to end, and then I can replay it again and start and listen to it from start to end, because it is just so beautiful.
Seen it evolve. I think we were talking before about how kind of being a white guy playing black music in quite an unusual situation. You know, you're in London, which has changed so much over the time that you've been involved in music, and deregulation of radio and in the latter days of Thatcher has obviously had a big effect on your life and people around you. How do you think that Britain has evolved, you know, over the last 30, 40 years?
Wow.
With music being obviously at the heart of how it's defined as a culture.
I think one of the things that I pull out of all of this is that in the last 35 years, we've seen a music which was predominantly underground and sort of was a niche style of music has it's become mainstream, if you look at kind of where we were when I was out first off disc jockeying and sort of trying to spread the word about Fatback Band and James Brown and everything else, and you just type of plot James Brown's career throughout all of this, yeah, and through the music that has been the music that's been kind of the come around, whether it's hip hop which used James Brown or the rare groove scene coming back, or now you can just play a James Brown track,
yeah,
and it doesn't have to be Sex Machine for people to go, wow, love that and want to dance to it.
Yeah.
It's become, and I think a bit like London itself, you know, there's so many cultures, it's such a melting pot of people and musics and everything else that it's now part of the mainstream. You know, you can go to a wedding and you don't have to just play Hi Ho Silver Lining and the latest Slade song or whatever. You can actually play music and people do like it, and you know, people have much more Catholic taste, and you know, what we were fighting for, you know, with black music is accepted now, you know, and kind of, if anything, it's become too accepted in some ways.
Yeah, tell me about your feeling about that, because, you know, we were talking before about how
I think that
you've lost it.
Well, I think that we were naive. When all of us DJs first was promoting this music and going, you've got to listen to this this Bobby Bird track, or you've got to listen to this Travaris track or whoever, and we wanted the world to know about all this music. And then we got to a point where when Kiss became legalized and music kind of the dance music and soul and R&B and rap and hip-hop and house and all these things was doing about 70-odd% of the charts, it was kind of, wow, we've done it. But we didn't own it, and it didn't feel right. We didn't feel like we'd won. Because I think that what happened was we were naive when we was trying to promote this music, because we never realised that anything that gets big gets taken over by the corporations, and it gets kind of diluted, and all of a sudden Usher's doing a remix with David Guetta, and it takes away all of that. Yeah, it's a massive hit or whatever, and it's kind of it's not what we set out to do. But we I think that's us being naive, really. Yeah. So that with regards to all that, it kind of feels as if we won, but we didn't really enjoy the winning.
I see. So your next track is presumably not Usher.
No, definitely not Usher. This is a track which I think the words to this, and I'm going to say that I met my wife 14 years ago, and we got married after about 10 years. And when we heard this track, it kind of summed up a lot of the feelings that we had for each other, and just such a well-written song. And there's two versions of it. There's Taurus Riley done a reggae version of it, and Robin Thicke, who done, as I understand, the original version of it. And it's called Superman, and it is just... It goes out for my wife, Deborah.
I'ma be there to take care of you. I'ma be there when you cry, babe. I'ma be there when you need someone to tell you that you're beautiful, baby. I'ma be there when you need someone to run with. I'ma be there when you need someone to dance with. I'm your lover when the skies turn grey. Every day till it's beautiful, baby. Oh, till it's beautiful, till it's beautiful, babe. Till it's beautiful, babe.
So, Gordon, we were talking about how you built up Kiss. You eventually sold it to EMAP. Tell me about how that progressed, because obviously taking a radio station to then be commercial, and the kind of natural frictions that appear between making money and playing all the music you love, obviously it's quite difficult. And how do you sort of stay professional whilst hanging on to the music? It must have been tricky, right?
I think a couple of things, really. I think that EMAP were good in a way because they initially they let me have my... I was doing something good. We was earning loads of money. We had loads of audience. And so it's kind of difficult to tell somebody to do it differently. And so we kind of had that. I was there. I was as MD of KISS for 7 years, from 1990 when we went on air till 97. December 97 is when I left. And I finished my show in April of 98. And I was a bit like a bowel, really, because there was the board above me, which were kind of saying, we've got to do better, and it's got to be more accessible, and it's got to be more this, and it's got to be more that. And then I had all the staff below me going, so they were giving me shit, which I had to then, and I had all the staff below me going, what's the matter with them? Can't they see we're successful? Can't they see what we're doing is good? Can't they see we're turning over millions of pounds and they're actually kind of really successful? Yeah. And they were giving me shit. And I was like this bowel in the middle, which had to cleanse everything that went through from the board to the staff, from the staff to the board. And that's how I saw my job for quite a while.
Half a suit on.
Because everybody at work there seems to love music.
Yeah.
And I'd walk into the accounts department and find the head of accounts having a big row with one of the DJs about the best house record that's out at the moment and stuff like that. I'd be like, for God's sake, can you just get on with accounts and can you get back down to programming? And because everybody in the building loved the music, and which was wonderful, but it was just... I can't tell you some of the stories that went on. I came in one day and found Steve Jackson tied to a chair in the sales department because they disagreed with his choice of house record on the show that day. And I can't talk to about
no
because...
No.
I mean, we found naked women in the studio. We found DJs absolutely off their trolley in the studios that we've had to take them out. We had a Christmas party one year in Camden Lock, and one of the sales people thought he was being funny to pick on one of the DJs that everybody else picks on. And because it was one of the suits that picks on one of the DJs just picked this salesperson up and chucks him in the lock. And I'm paying for lungs to be pumped out and everything, because Camden Lock's not the prettiest of locks in the world. And it just merging all these people together. It was there's a very, very funny book, and one that I could probably get sued quite a lot for.
I'll ghostwrite it for you. So what's next on your playlist?
The next one on my playlist kind of bridges a gap, because it's an old reggae record, because I love reggae, as you know. But it also was taken by one of the massive rave outfits back in the day, and it kind of it puts the two together, and it's Max Romeo called Chase the Devil. And I'll let you work out what song it was taken with the rave thing. You just got to play it.
I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase Satan out of earth. I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase the devil out of earth. Send him to outer space to find another race. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. Satan is a evil-o's man, but him can't choke sit on I man. So when I check him, my lass in hand, and if him slip a gun with him hand, I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase Satan. Put on an iron shirt and chase the devil out of earth. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. Oh yeah.
That's brilliant. So we're just bring a bit of a carnival feel.
That's right. Because you have to mix in the Prodigy and Outer Space into that to actually kind of, then it goes mad.
Yeah, blessed enough to see you do that live as a lucky person. So go and tell me about My Soul then. It's your online station. You've taken it onto digital radio. It's about 3 years old.
Yep.
What was your original concept? Why get back into the radio game?
I came out the radio game after I finished at KISS. And came out and sort of done loads of other things that I wanted to do and went around the world and
sort of fun, didn't you?
I did. Yeah, I went and had fun. That's the polite way of saying it, yeah. And then I had a bar and restaurant and nightclub and Caribbean restaurant and done all these different things. And after that, in 2007, I came out of all that and I got that out of my system, and the recession came, and I got asked. I sat there myself, my wife. We sat there, and we said, "Okay, what do we want to do now? Do we want to stay running clubs and doing things at night, or do we want to get a daytime job and sort of, you know, get our social life back?" And also at the same time, I was so disenfranchised from any radio, really, and kind of radio. I've always loved radio, and there was this new thing called internet radio, which kind of I was starting to get into, and I found kind of appealing. And it's kind of, you know, because it's why the youth today aren't championing any real music, because they can get whatever they want, whenever they want, on their devices. Because, you know, the youth listen to everything, and they don't seem to go to the theatre because they watch everything on their phone or on their laptop or on their pad. And
but one of the things I think is great about you is that you're not backwards looking, you know, you're excited by these developments.
Oh goodness, I think that, yeah, music. Definitely. And so with all of this, it kind of really made me look at kind of, okay, the radio market. And I believe on, you know, kind of, I got asked to go and do some consultancy work on a couple of stations, which I'd done, and looked at the marketplace and looked at kind of what the offering was that was actually out there. And I believe that the future is via the internet. That is the future, 3, 5, 7 years time. And so I thought that there needs to be a kind of a station which is for the post-KISS generation. It's kind of for, as it were, KISS adults. And for all those people that used to listen to KISS and Choice and those stations between the year 1990 and 2005, which now have grown up and they're kind of out of the age range, because these stations are kind of 12 to 24-year-old stations. And once you get to type of 30, 35, then you become, you know, you want a little bit that's a little bit easier. And also, there's not a station out there that covers off the music that we all used to play by all the DJs. And all those DJs, and I've got 70 DJs now on My Soul, ranging from Greg Edwards to Ronnie Harrell, who used to be on One Extra for 10 years, to Jazzy B, to, I mean, I don't know, George Kay, who does The Breakfast Show. I mean, but there's so many great radio DJs out there that have done radio in the past but haven't got gigs on them now because their audience are all over 30.
Yeah.
And so I thought there's a real hole in the market for this. So we tested it, doing it for 3 years on internet.
Yeah.
And we've just taken the plunge to go onto DAB. The big problem with internet radio is you don't wake up with your computer going on.
Yeah.
It kind of, you wake up with a DAB radio, and more people in the latest radio, more people listen to digital radio than they do to FM in London. Yeah. So we felt that now is the time to actually go on and sort of just make our mark and actually fulfil a gap that's not being catered for out there.
So what's your final choice then?
My final choice is a record which just, oh goodness me, I've got so many records that I could finish on, there really is. But I'm not going to do a My Soul record. I'm going to do a record which just to me is probably one of the most perfect records ever, which for me to say that is kind of pretty kind of, that's a big statement for me. But I really do believe that it is a pretty perfect record. It's Etta James and At Last. I just love this.
It's beautiful.
At last, my love has come along. My lonely days are over. Wrapped up in clover. The night I looked at you,
Etta James with That Last there, such a fantastic song. I could talk to you all day, but this has been fantastic. So obviously we've catapulted you into the desert.
Yes.
How do you think you'd cope?
Terribly. Although I'd rather be in the desert than in the snow, so I prefer the sun.
Be all right.
Yeah.
And we're very generous here on Desert Isolation Discs. We give you the complete Red Dwarf box set and the Tiger Who Came to Tea. We'll give you another luxury item. Anything that you couldn't be without?
It would probably a computer. That's probably my first choice, but. Probably a cappuccino maker, but I'd have to have a sugar grove near me so I could put some sugar in my coffee.
I like it. A very stylish approach. Go on, Matt. It's been an absolute pleasure hearing your Desert Isolation Discs. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Great being here.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.